All right. Well, I'm going to be sharing for the next, many minutes here and sharing some thoughts that I hope are helpful and they're important thoughts to hear. But I also wanted to say that perhaps the best thing that you will potentially listen to this weekend happened yesterday. And that was at the memorial service of our dear friend, Tracy Mueller. And Tracy, as many of you know, he just recently passed away, but he, since birth, has been unable to use his arms and legs, and yet he lived a remarkable life, a truly remarkable life that inspired so many of us and that instructed so many of us in powerful, powerful ways. I want to read a quick line from his obituary. It says, Tracy believed his physical limitations were not accidents, but assignments. I'll read that again. Tracy believed his physical limitations were not accidents, but assignments, a sacred calling through which he could demonstrate the divine presence often appears in unexpected forms. And his service yesterday was a testimony to that. And so I wanted to encourage you right off the bat, if you weren't able to make it yesterday, to watch the service. And you can get to it through our website or our YouTube page. It's a long service. There were a lot of people that had a lot to share about Tracy, but it's worth your time. So I'd encourage you to do that. You will be refreshed, especially if you are experiencing any kind of physical limitations or other kinds of limitations. You will be blessed. Also, I wanted to make you aware that there are some tables out here in the lobby, and there are going to be various items and later, I think, some food left over from Tracy's service that you are welcome to take home with you. All right. Secondly, I wanted to just remind you of what's happening this upcoming week. Remember, as Travis shared, next weekend is Easter, and so we will have a Good Friday service right here at 7 p.m. on Friday. And then, of course, our Easter service a week from today, starting at the usual time, 9:30 a.m. In between those two services is Service Saturday. And so this is something that we do every other month. We take a morning and we serve people who could use some help. And so join us 8 a.m. on Saturday morning, and we'll divvy you up and send you to various projects to help serve people in need. All right, let me catch you up. If you're new with us, again, like Travis said, welcome. We are really glad you could join us this morning. I'm going to catch us up to where we're at, what we're doing on Sunday mornings right now. We are in at the very beginning of what will be a long multi-part series that we're calling Established. Okay? And really the key summary verse is probably Colossians 2, 6, and 7. Which says, therefore, as you receive Christ Jesus the Lord, so walk in him, rooted and built up in him and established in the faith. Just as you were taught, abounding in thanksgiving, we want to be established in the faith, have our roots go down deep to soak in some of the basic fundamental principles that are given to us in the Bible and understand who God is. We're going to be doing that, like I said, over a long period of time, as we use three different books to help establish us, books of the Bible. And those three books of the Bible will help us be established in three different ways. Number one, we want to be established in creation, and we're using Genesis 1 through 11 to do that. Genesis 1 through 11 lays out some really important foundational ideas that shape everything. And so we're going to try to soak in those for a while, and that's what we're doing right now. We're in week 4. Secondly, we're going to teach through the book of Colossians, and that's going to help us become established in Christ, who Jesus is and what he did for us. And then we're going to teach through the book of Titus, and that will help us help to establish us in community or the church. And then we have a bonus C. We're going to talk about the culmination, what God is bringing to completion in this world. So again, we're at the very beginning of that. We're still in Genesis chapter 1. Last week, Perry talked about the image of God and how we all, as human beings, are created in the image of God. Well, this week, we are going to take really that same passage or a subset of that passage and zero in on a specific aspect of our image bearing. And so let me read these couple of verses. Genesis 1, 26 through 27. Then God said, let us make man in our image, after our likeness, and let them have dominion over the fish of the sea and over the birds of the heavens and over the livestock and over all the earth and over every creeping thing that creeps on the earth. So God created man in his own image. In the image of God, he created him. Male and female, he created them. And really, we're going to focus on that last line. Male and female, he created them. So our topic this morning is gender. It's gender, one of the most discussed and one of the most contentious topics in our world in recent years. And I realize that there are probably all kinds of ideas and positions and perspectives and experiences, baggage, related to this topic of gender and sexuality. And the temptation, therefore, is to ignore it. But I think instead we should dig in. And we should try to understand what the Bible communicates about this very contentious topic. And hopefully work towards a place of understanding and even of unity around this topic. Now, this morning, I am not going to share exhaustively on gender at all. In fact, I may not answer many or even any of the burning questions, the specific questions that you have. And you may leave somewhat unsatisfied this morning because of that. However, if you leave unsatisfied, I just want to encourage you to wait a few weeks. And we may talk about some of those burning questions, those specific questions, a little bit more later on. After all, as we go through the early chapters of Genesis, we are going to get several opportunities to talk about this topic. So for example, today we are talking about gender as it relates to the image of God, using the couple of verses that I just read. But in a few weeks, by the way, we're taking a bit of a break from our Genesis series over the next few weeks because we have an Easter message next week, and then we have a couple weeks of our missions campaign. And so we'll take a little bit of a break, but then we'll come back to Genesis. And later we're going to talk about the creation of Eve. And there's a lot there. And then a few weeks after that, we'll get to the curse and see how that affected both men and women. So in some ways, we're having a little mini-series on gender this spring, but each of those teachings are just spaced several weeks apart. And in addition to that, as I said earlier, we're going to go through the books of Colossians and Titus later on, and each of those books has a passage in it that relates to gender and relates to husbands and wives or men and women. And so we are going to get quite a bit of opportunity to cover this topic. And so this morning is just introduction. It's just overview. It's just trying to lay down a foundational principle or two related to gender. Now, before we get into that, I wanted to offer a quick encouragement, and that is to give the Bible a fair hearing as we do this. As we walk through these ideas, these potentially difficult ideas, to give the Bible a fair hearing. And I would encourage that, especially of those of you that maybe you wouldn't call yourself a believer yet. Maybe you're here because you're curious. Maybe you're starting to consider God and what's out there. And as you consider Christianity, there are things that you're drawn to that are attractive, that stir you in some way, and you're drawn to the Bible and to Christianity, except when it comes to this issue. Because you've heard what Christians supposedly think about gender, about sexuality, and you say that's a hill I can't get over. Well, I want to encourage you to perhaps leave some of those maybe preconceived ideas, some of those sound bites behind, and enter into the conversation ready and willing to just examine what the Bible says and see if there's actually something very profound here related to gender. Life-giving, even liberating here in the Bible. After all, I think many of us would admit if we just honestly considered our lives and we consider how the principles that we've been given from the world about gender and sexuality for the last 60 plus years especially, if we consider that, we might question if those ideas, that whole sexual revolution has truly delivered on its promises. Has it really given what it seemed to promise, or has it left us impoverished? I think many of us would say, I think we're in a bad place. And maybe it's time to reconsider some of these ancient ideas found in the Bible. Okay, so again, this morning is pretty foundational, just introductory. And what we're really trying to do is just answer this simple question, why gender? Why gender? Why would God, if gender is a created thing, why on earth would God create gender? With all of the complications that came along with it, why would God do that? After all, did he really have to? Did he have to make reproduction happen as it does? Could he have done something else that didn't require gender? Different sexual anatomies? Could we have just, maybe we drink something and it causes us to reproduce? Or maybe it didn't even involve us. Maybe God just continues to directly make new people out of the dirt. You know, why would he do things like he did and introduce gender and everything that came along with it? Well, that's what we're going to try to tackle. And I think that's a question that Genesis helps us with. And Genesis helps us with these kinds of questions. Genesis helps us with the teleological questions, the what is the purpose of blank? And we're going to try to understand a little bit more, see what Genesis implies about the purpose of gender. So let's get back to Genesis chapter 1. And from these verses that I just read, let's start with the first line where God says, "Let us make man in our image, after our likeness." And what stumbles us there right off the bat, of course, is the us and the our as plural. After all, we read even the early chapters of Genesis, but we read the whole Bible and it seems pretty clear that God is one. Okay, this is a monotheistic religion that the Bible creates. God is one. And so why very early on here in the Bible, in the first few paragraphs, we get this us and this our. Why the plural? Well, there have been a few possibilities that have been proposed. Number one, perhaps God is just using what we would call the royal we. Okay, the royal we, I'll read Wikipedia's definition of the royal we. The royal we is the use of a plural pronoun, like we, us, or our, by a single person, typically a monarch, bishop, or high official, to refer to themselves, signifying their official capacity, authority, and divine right, rather than just their personal identity. So sometimes this is almost just a figure of speech where the plural is used to convey some sort of authority or it's used for some reason like that. I mean, sometimes we even do that up here. Like I might share it kind of like that where I'd say this morning, we're gonna talk about gender. Really, I'm gonna talk about gender. But we use that kind of language. And so maybe God is just using this kind of magisterial we to communicate something. But from what I've read, there are issues with that, and that seems unlikely linguistically. After all, it doesn't seem like ancient Hebrew used the royal we. And so it seems unlikely that this is what is going on here. Second possibility might be he's speaking to his divine council. Okay, this is the throne room of God, and all his angels are assembled. We see other situations like that in the Bible where he is speaking to his divine council, and this could be plausible also. Okay, the we, the our, is God and all of his angels. But again, there have been objections to this, especially because the context seems to indicate that it's talking about God. Especially because he's saying we are making God, making man in our image. It doesn't seem like he's including the angels in that. Like man's being made in the image of God and all the angels. No, it seems like saying God. So the other possibility is that this is just a hint or a foreshadowing of what becomes clear later on in the Bible, and that this is a foreshadowing of the Trinity. And this incredible idea about God that is put forth in the Bible, that God is one, and yet there are three distinct persons within that oneness, a Father, Son, and Spirit. And I think the majority of Christians throughout the last 2,000 years have assumed that this is that foreshadowing, that hint right here at the beginning of the Bible, that God is speaking of his plural nature. Now, the Trinity is something that is obviously very difficult to comprehend, and yet it gives us so much wonder and beauty when we consider what the Trinity is. Travis talked about this the first week of our series. And the Trinity means that certain things are uncreated, such as love. Okay, love didn't come about later on. It's not like God had to create us and then he had something to love. But no, love is primary. It's always been. The Father has always been loving the Son, as it says in John 17:24. So love is primary, love is uncreated. But also we could say that diversity within unity has always been there. Okay, within God, there's been diversity and unity in some way. This is uncreated again. This is a primary attribute of God. It's not derivative. So with that in mind, God's primary nature being diverse unity, let's sort of revisit creation week of Genesis 1. And you can open up your Bibles to page 1, and we're just going to kind of skim through this first chapter. And this is what John took us through a couple weeks ago. But I want to reread or re-skim this chapter and just try to get across that throughout this week, God is just introducing diversity and he's injecting what I'm just gonna call complementary contrast throughout creation week because it originates in him. So in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. That's the first statement of the Bible. God created something out of nothing. He made it, and so he made the earth, but the earth was, it says, without form and void. So it was unstructured. There, it was hard to define it. Okay, there was just some sort of matter, some substance, but it's pretty formless. And it describes it as waters. It's just waters, kind of chaotic waters, and the Spirit of God is hovering over these waters. But then God starts doing things. And the first thing he does is he makes light. He says, let there be light. And there's light and there's darkness. And so immediately he creates this contrast. Okay, there's light and darkness. And that creates this cycle to sort of measure time, where there's a day and another day and another day. But there's light and darkness that are created. Again, this contrast, you could say this complementary contrast. Now, after that, it says that, again, there are these waters, whatever that meant or whatever that looked like. And then it says that God separates them. So he separates the waters and creates what is called an expanse between these waters. And this expanse becomes the heavens or the sky or the outer world here. And but he separates these waters. He's adding some sort of distinction here. And then he goes on, and then he takes the waters that are on the earth, and again he separates. He's going to create this contrast again, and he separates the waters from dry land. And so he creates dry land, and he's injecting this contrast in again. And after that, he creates plant life, and vegetation begins to sprout. But what it says about the vegetation is that it's all created according to its kind. So there are multiple kinds of plants that are created. So there's distinction there. Okay, he's taken this one substance and he's just creating distinction and diversity in it. And then he goes on, and now he's going to create the greater light and the lesser light to sort of govern the day and the night and have these specific sources of light. The sun and the moon and the stars. Again, he's creating contrasts, separating things, and distinction. And then next he gets to the animals, and he creates the sea creatures and the birds, and eventually he gets to land animals. And again, they're all created according to their kind. There's different kinds. Okay, there's diversity here in the creation and in the biology, and he just keeps taking the one thing that was already there and he's separating it, and he's making two things that kind of contrast but complement each other. And he continues to do that throughout Creation Week. Now, before we get to the culmination of Creation Week, let me skip ahead to Genesis chapter 2 and talk about what God gives the man to do. Now, of course, the man was to tend the garden, but in addition to that, we read this. Genesis 2, 19 through 20. Now, out of the ground, the Lord had formed every beast of the field and every bird of the heavens and brought them to the man to see what he would call them. Whatever the man called every living creature, that was its name. The man gave names to all livestock and to the birds of the heavens and to every beast of the field. It seems like this initial discipline that God gave man was taxonomy. It was categorizing things. It was labeling all the diversity that he had just created. And that's what man's supposed to do. Adam was supposed to create a spreadsheet, basically. That's why we should love spreadsheets. Okay, he's just supposed to label and categorize everything that God had brought into being. That's really interesting. This is different than any other origin story. This is the initial task. It's categorizing diversity. Because we see that this is a wonderful good that God is bringing. He's bringing this contrast. He's bringing this diversity. And we have this grounding for this intuitive sense that we all feel that diversity is a good thing. Okay, diversity is a good thing. I mean, we could look at it in as we look at our natural world. Say we look at a picture like this, this kind of scene. And we see all the contrasting colors. And we see the oranges, the golds, the flaming oranges, or the flaming reds, and the blues and the purples and the sky, and we say this is beauty here. This is beauty because of this diversity and this contrast that we see in simply the color. Now, if we remove that color and just made it more kind of monochromatic, we would lose so much there. We'd lose so much of the beauty and the wonder because God was creating this sort of diversity. And obviously, he did the same thing with the animals and just the whole world. As he made all of this wonder and all of this contrast and all of this diversity, and again, it gives us a grounding for our appreciation of diversity, even in the biological world. I don't think other worldviews give that kind of grounding. I mean, if you were purely materialistic, should you value the diversity of this world like that? Should you care if the black rhino is eliminated? So, well, I don't know that you should. I mean, species have come and gone. Lots of them have gone extinct over the ages. And so why really care if you lose some of that diversity? I think that evolutionary mindset actually points you towards eliminating diversity. Let's get rid of the unneeded. And let's try to just approach more of that oneness. I think the Bible gives you reason to value diversity, and it's why that resonates so deeply within us. Just naturally, we appreciate all of this because God made it. And I think this just reflects some things. Again, we can go back to who God is and see how he projected himself into the world. And so we can draw these kinds of conclusions. Because they find their origin in God himself, we could say that these kinds of things are fundamentally good. And these are kind of three ways of saying the same thing, but united diversity, complementary contrast, interdependence. Okay, these things are fundamentally good. Again, they're not derivative. They didn't come about later. They are somehow reflections of who God is in his very nature. And so we should love these things and see them as good and valuable. So that gets us to the culmination of creation week. When God makes man in his own image, he'd been injecting all of this contrast into the world day after day after day, and then he gets to human beings. And it says, male and female, he created them. That is the image of God. And so even in this crowning creative work, he takes the thing that he had made, human, and even that he separates. It creates his contrasts, makes two different kinds of humans. Because that's what he wanted to communicate. That's who he is in himself in some sense. And so he injects that even into humanity. It is so interesting, I think, that when the Bible here is talking about the image of God, it doesn't detail out everything that goes into that image. Like, what are those attributes that we share with God that reflect who he is, that reflect his image? There are a whole bunch of potential candidates. Perry mentioned some of those last week. You know, do we reflect the image of God because of our consciousness or our moral inclinations or whatever? Maybe so. I think probably yes. But the one feature of image bearer that we are explicitly given here in Genesis 1 is male and female. Wow. I think that's pretty profound. That's really, really interesting. But the one thing that he puts forward is male and female, because male and female was going to reflect some of that complementary contrast or diverse unity that is within himself. And so from this simple statement, we get such foundational ideas, and we can look at male and female and we can say they are equal, but they are different. And that's what Genesis 1 gives us. They are equal and yet they are different. And let's think about each one of those. First of all, male and female are equal. Now again, I don't know that other worldviews naturally give this to us. Okay, the equality of male and female. Because you could look at that, again, more naturalistic, materialistic perspective, and you assume that somewhere along the road, evolution produced male and female, but it produced male as physically stronger. And so So you consider that and say, no, male and female are not equal. Okay, there are these differences here, and it seems like males are superior because they're stronger physically. But that's only if you're measuring on that attribute. If that's kind of the primary thing that you're considering, physical strength, upper body strength, then that's where you get to. But if the primary thing that you're measuring around is image bearer, how you project the image of God, then you can say they're equal. Male and female are equal because they're equal in value, they're equal in dignity. They both bring this reflection of who God is, and both are invaluable. And so male and female are equal. And this, I believe, is why women have actually fared very, very well in societies that have been shaped by the Bible. I mean, we certainly saw this through the original sexual revolution of the first century, where the Christian story began to change sexual norms in the Roman world. And the New Testament wrote things like this, 1 Corinthians 7. This is a radical statement. It's not radical to us. We kind of gloss over it, but this is crazy. The husband should give to his wife her conjugal rights, and likewise the wife to her husband. For the wife does not have authority over her own body, but the husband does. And there's no controversy there, of course. Of course the husband has authority over the body of his wife. That was pretty standard in the Roman world of the first century. But then there's the next line. Likewise, the husband does not have authority over his own body, but the wife does. What? That's revolutionary. But it is because 1 Corinthians 7 was built on Genesis 1. Genesis 1 started that. And then when Jesus came along and he clarified some things, and then 1 Corinthians 7 could be written because there is an equality between male and female. And yet at the same time, they are different. And this is where the rub is. This is what can stumble us. This is where it gets difficult for us, because it's hard for us to think that this could be true, because we naturally assume that equal equals same. Equal must be sameness. It's hard for us to imagine two things being equal if they have different aptitudes or different potentials. It's just really hard for us. But again, that's because we're measuring off the wrong things. And when we say what our core identity is, what so much of what defines us as human beings is image bearer, then we can say two things can be different and yet still equal in value and dignity and in contribution to the reflection of the image of God. They can be different. But here's what the hard part is. Admittedly, differences require limitations. If two things are different, they are limited from being each other. Okay, there are certain attributes that one has that the other doesn't. Okay, so differences by necessity require limitations. But I'm going to propose that again is a good thing. We have been told that limitations are bad. We should discard all limitations. But I'm going to say that they're good. We could go back to our picture here. And I'm going to say it's a good thing that the orange is limited to being orange. Okay, that it doesn't try to throw off its orangeness and be green, but it's limited to being orange. And because it has those limitations around us, it brings everything that orange brings in a phenomenal way. because it embraces those limitations, therefore, it can bring all the goodness that is packed into what it is. Those limitations are good. After all, we could ask this question. What if the goal is not independency, but instead interdependency? Now again, we have been told all our lives that independency is a great good. It's virtuous. We really value our independency, and therefore we hate limitations. We don't think there should be any. Okay, I can do anything that I want. Okay, you do you. And we throw off our limitations and we cry out for our independency. But what if interdependency is more of the goal? And I think we see this in all kinds of situations, the value of interdependency. Of course, we see it in the church. And God wanted this kind of thing to flow into his church also, not just through gender, but in many different ways. So we could go to 1 Corinthians 12 and read about how the church is like a body with many members. We are each a member of the body. For the body does not consist of one member, but of many. If the foot should say, because I'm not a hand, I do not belong to the body, that would not make it any less a part of the body. And if the ear should say, because I am not an eye, I do not belong to the body, that would not make it any less a part of the body. If the whole body were an eye, where would be the sense of hearing? If the whole body were an ear, where would be the sense of smell? But as it is, God arranged the members in the body, each one of them as he chose. If all were a single member, where would the body be? As it is, there are many parts, yet one body. Again, there are differences and there are limitations. Okay, the ear is an ear, and the hand a hand, and the eye an eye. So they are limited. The ear doesn't do what an eye does, and the eye doesn't do what a hand does. They are limited, but that's how God chose it to be. God chose to shape these differences into his church, in order to create interdependency, where I don't bring everything that I could, that could possibly be brought. I depend on somebody else to bring those pieces that I cannot. And of course, again, we see this everywhere. We see the beauty of interdependency all over. Of course, we see it through sports teams. You know, the quarterback is the one that gets all the glory, but he is fully dependent on the offensive lineman. If the offensive lineman isn't there, the quarterback is sunk. Okay, he just can't do what he's supposed to do. The offensive lineman might not get the glory, but he's absolutely essential. Similarly, in a volleyball match, I played a little bit of volleyball when I was younger, not real formally, but There are few things that are sweeter than striking that ball perfectly, hitting it straight down on the other side of the net, and humiliating your opponent. Okay, I never got it real often, but when you connected with that ball, it was incredible. But of course, the glory that the hitter experiences in hitting that ball is fully dependent on the setter. And that setter has to loft that ball up in the right location for that hitter to do what that hitter does. Obviously, in an orchestra, all these interdependent parts, and the violin is very good, but you don't want all violins. Okay, you don't want all piccolos or timpanis. Okay, That gets ugly. Okay, when you have an orchestra of piccolos. Okay, the orchestra must be arranged with all of these people playing their roles in an appropriate proportion. And when that happens, there is a beauty. There's an incredible beauty that comes about. So again, the goal is not independency, but instead interdependency, which requires differences, that is limitations, in order to create a beautiful complementarity. Okay, these things are good when we are limited, when there are differences. And that brings us back to male and female. This is true in an orchestra, on a volleyball team, on a football team, in the church. And it's even true within humanity itself, where male and female are equal but limited and interdependent. You know, one of the examples that often comes to mind for me when I think about the differences between men and women is this. And it's kind of a ridiculous example, just a quick warning. But what I think about is my bachelor party. This is my bachelor party. Now, bachelor parties have a certain reputation. There's a stereotype there. Often that stereotype is like drunken debauchery. Now, I was a Christian, and my friends and my best man were Christians. That wasn't the route we took. But nevertheless, my friends still chose to torment me at my bachelor party. And here's what they did. Here's what my best man crafted for this party. He was actually already married, and his wife was expecting, they were expecting their first child. And so with that in mind, he decided that during my party, he would dress me up like a pregnant woman, okay? And here's how he did that. So beforehand, he had asked Christy, my wife, a number of questions about herself. And then during the party, I was supposed to answer those questions, those same questions as she would answer, as I would assume she would answer them. But of course, the questions were really obscure, and the goal was for me to get them wrong. And so each time I got a question wrong, an article of clothing was added to me. And so like a pillow was wrapped around my belly and behind and even in between my legs. So when I walked, I waddled. And then maternity clothing was added to me. And so this happened over a series of wrong answers. After I was fully outfitted, they took me out to the front street in front of our house. And then they formed two lines on either side of the street. And each guy was equipped with a super soaker or some ingredient from the kitchen. And again, for the wrong answers that I got, I had to run back and forth between this gauntlet while they blasted me and threw flour and brown sugar and molasses on me. I found a picture. So there's. So they just plastered me with goo. And that's what they did to me. I'll take that down. That's disturbing. Now, I bring that up because that kind of thing, I do not believe, has been done in the history of bridal showers. And I heard about my wife's bridal shower, and it was very different. And there was an elegance to it, elegant decorations. There were tasty desserts, and they dressed nicely. And get this, they honored and encouraged her. I was shocked as well when I heard. And I just look at that and I say, there's something different. Okay, when a group of men get together and a group of women get together, there tends to be a very, very different result. And again, that's a ridiculous, silly example, but is there something there? Is there something there where masculinity and femininity tend to be expressed in different ways? Even in goofy things like that. There's just a difference there. And we can try to deny those differences, but I believe that reality smacks us. And we look around and we look at how men and women gather together, and again, what they tend to emphasize. And sure, there are generalities and there are exceptions and all of this, but there is something that comes out of masculinity and there is something that comes out of femininity. And they're different. But I'm going to say they're good. That each is very good. And when I see that, you know, the guys, they hear about the bridal shower and they say, that sounds boring. And the girls, they just shake their head when they hear about the bachelor party. It's like there's just a different way of thinking, perhaps. When we recognize those differences, because again, I believe that we do, and when we come together, say, as spouses, we recognize differences. I experience that my wife thinks differently than I do. When I recognize that, though, that she thinks differently than I do, if I don't have these Genesis 1 ideas, I think it's easy for me to resent those differences. To say, it's not just that she's thinking differently, she's thinking wrongly. She should think like me. But it's not that she's thinking wrongly. She's thinking like a woman. And that is a good, as Genesis says, a very good thing. And I can value and esteem that now. And I can say, it's not just that she's thinking differently. No, she's thinking in a way that I don't naturally think, and she's filling in the gaps. Together, we're producing something. And when I believe that, we're equal. We have an equal perspective here, but we're different, so we're each going to bring different things, so there is an interdependency. There's a great value now that I have on her thoughts. I truly value her thoughts if I'm seeing things through this lens. Because here's what I think is true. Differences/limitations under equality create interdependence, which leads to mutual appreciation, which enhances love. I believe that Genesis 1 leads to love. It leads to mutual appreciation. That those limitations are good, those distinctions, those differences are very, very good. And if we blur them, we lose something so incredibly valuable. Travis and Lily, you can go ahead and come on back up here. I want to remind you again of what I shared at the very beginning from Tracy's obituary. It said, limitations are not accidents, but assignments. Limitations are not accidents, but assignments. And I think that's applicable, of course, in Tracy's situation, but even through gender. Okay, each gender is limited. I am limited. I cannot express femininity like my wife can, and vice versa. So we are limited. But those are not accidents, those are assignments. And there's an incredible good that comes together when we see the value of that interdependency, see the value of those limitations. And that's why Genesis 1:31 can end like this, and God saw everything that he had made, and behold, it was very good. Very good, because of all that contrast and diversity that he had injected into the weak, and then especially into human beings. And really, I think this even leads us to how we relate to God. The Christian story, the Christian message is that we must acknowledge our limitations, our weaknesses, our inability, our lack, and then let somebody else fill in. So it's different than how we see things with gender, but there's some similarity there where I have to acknowledge that I am incomplete. I lack the ability to do everything that I need to do. But Jesus fills in. And he comes and he unites himself with me and recreates me to be acceptable before God. But one of the first steps to receiving that is simply acknowledging limitations, acknowledging that I am dependent. But there is incredible freedom and even liberation on the other side of that. When we acknowledge that I'm dependent, I'm needy, I'm weak, I need somebody else, and I need Jesus to take over and take me home.